Hi guys, I'm a little bit intoxicated, so I wanted to read something kind of deep, inspired by my recent visit to Salem, Massachusetts. I don't know if deep and intoxicated go together, but this just sounds like a nice idea right now. So, while I was in Salem, I bought a copy of A Delusion of Satan, which is the full story of the Salem witch trials. All detail, no bullshit or nothing. Except I think I can only read a few pages, if not the whole chapter. So, let's get on with it. Chapter 1. Sowing the dragon's teeth. My cat just ran in the bed. I hope he doesn't cause a lot of noise. Almost 30 died. Well, over 100 languished for months in cramped, dark, stinking prisons, hungry and thirsty, never moving from the walls they were chained to. Unsure if they would ever go free. Some were tortured by the strange method known as tying neck and heels, their bodies forced into hoops, necks roped to feet. Others were made to stand without rest during interminable sessions of questioning. Many were even more exquisitely tortured by knowing that their children were left unprovided for when they were seized. Mothers wondering if their baby still lived. By the spring of 1693, despair lay almost as heavy outside the prisons as in. Farms had been neglected while families traveled long distances on horseback or foot to visit their relatives in prison and to attend their examinations and trials. Some of those families had been impoverished or bankrupt by the disruption of work and the need to pay for the upkeep of their jailed mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, husbands and wives. It seems incredible today, but prisoners were responsible for prison fees for their board and lodging, their fetters and chains. Many were without income or assets. Some had been poor, even destitute, before they were accused. Others had their estates and their possessions seized by the sheriff on imprisonment, at times so vindictively that cattle were killed, beer poured out of barrels, and broth tossed from pots. Children were left to shift for themselves or be saved from starvation by the mercy of neighbors. The witchcraft hysteria, which had begun in Salem Village a year before, had wrecked eastern Massachusetts as would a civil war. It had started in the unlikeliest setting. Salem Village Parsonage was a good-sized house by the standards of 17th century New England, though it would seem to us small. It had 4 rooms, 2 upstairs, 2 on the ground floor, and a lean-to structure built on the back, used as a dairy and brewery. Excluding this addition, the house was 42 feet long and 20 feet wide. Inside the heavy wooden front door was an entranceway, from which steps led down to a cellar. Beyond them stood a massive brick chimney, providing a fireplace in each of the rooms, even those upstairs. The huge hearth in the main room or hall was equipped with a spit for roasting pigs, chickens, and sides of beef, hooks to hang cauldrons for stews, and an oven in a wall for overnight bread baking. In winter, most of the life of the house went on near its warmth. The other ground floor room was probably used as a bedroom. Dwellings of this size in New England sometimes house 12 or 13. This one contained only 8. However, the tensions were extreme. Samuel Pierce, the pastor, was a man obsessed with the sinfulness he saw everywhere and with his own importance and status. He believed himself ill-treated by a faction in the village. His great terror was of Satan arming his foes to destroy both him and his church. He has gone down in history as the person most responsible for the coming calamity, and fundamentally this is true. Not just because when events got underway, he helped drive them on, but because at the deepest level his own fears created them. He looked for evil everywhere, but in his own life and heart. Out of his denial came the devils that destroyed the very community he strove to keep safe. It was no accident that Satan strode forth from God's house. Paris had come to Salem Village 3 years before with his wife, 3 children, 11-year-old niece Abigail Williams, and a Caribbean slave couple, Tituba and John Indian. Among the children was an impressionable 9-year-old daughter, Elizabeth, called Betty, steeped in her father's Puritan theology that made terrifying absolutes of good and evil, sin and saintliness, and heaven and hell. Unsurprisingly, she was full of anxiety. Abigail seemed, on the surface, a tougher personality, but in her own way, she was as fragile. When Paris's wife was unwell or out visiting, the 2 girls were left in Tituba's care. Their relationship with the slave must have been uneasy. It was unusual for New Englanders to own slaves, and as Caribbean Indians rather than Negroes, Tituba and John Indian were especially suspect even to the people they lived with. The Puritans believed that Native Americans were servants of the devil or devils themselves. It is unlikely that even close daily contact could eliminate such prejudice. The girls would have despised and half feared Tituba as well as feeling dependent on her. Paris may sometimes have anxiously wondered what his young charges were up to when alone in her company. As it happened, he had cause for concern. In the atmosphere of fear, guilt, and suspicion he had created, they indulged in pastimes that gradually led to catastrophe. The family included 2 other offspring, a 10-year-old boy and a 5-year-old girl. The family was unusual not only for owning slaves, but for having only 3 children. The norm in Puritan New England was for 1 child to follow another at intervals of about 2 years until they were between 5 and 10. This was so much the case that the Paris's small number of children indicate that Elizabeth Paris, the pastor's wife, was not in good health. The 4-year gap between Betty and her sister, Susanna, and the failure to produce a 4th child suggests difficulties with conception or a series of miscarriages. Samuel Paris was to offer father 2 more offspring by a 2nd wife after Elizabeth died. Elizabeth's death in 1696, at 48, gives added strength to suspicion of chronic poor health. Her epitaph suggests a long illness. Thou hast thy longed wish within Abraham's breast. She is a shadowy figure in our story, lauded on her tombstone as an excellent wife, mother, neighbor, and a friend, but otherwise left undescribed. What was not unusual in the Paris household was the presence of a young person who was not the parents' daughter or son. It was very common among New England Puritans for children to live in families other than their own. Historians have speculated that the Puritans were so terrified of the overindulgence of earthly affections that they often removed from their homes a major temptation, their offspring. But there were usually more practical reasons, economic or social. Abigail was probably taken in by the Parises for the simple reason that she was an orphan. There is no mention of her parents in any contemporary records. All we know of her background is that she had almost certainly come with the Parises 3 years before she and Betty made history. It seems probable that the adult slept in one upstairs room and Paris used the other as his study. The children may have slept in a smaller room downstairs, and the slave couple by the remains of the fire in the living room. A rope bed may have been set against the wall in the daytime and lowered at night. The couple may have simply lain on the hay strewn on the floorboards. Betty and Abigail and the other two children spent their days and nights in the small house, which in winter was as icy indoors as out. Heat dissipated within feet of the fire. When the temperature dropped to well below freezing, water froze on the earth. The winter of 1692 was a particularly cold one. On those frigid January mornings, the girls would be woken by the creaking of floorboards, or the rumble of the Reverend Paris's voice, or the sound of Tituba pumping the bellows to breathe new life into the fire. The girls arose in the dark, scrambled into several layers of shifts, skirts, and bodices, in a hurry to the hearth. There the chorus of the amens of the family's prayers, led by the pastor. Breakfast was by the candlelight, even if daybreak had come, and Tituba had slid open the shutters, for the little windows in their tiny panes of dark glass let in so little light that in deep winter candles were needed all day. After clearing the table, the girls began sewing, spinning, helping with the cooking, or washing and cleaning. There was always plenty of work, since the family, like any other in that time and place, made their own bread, butter, cider, ale, clothes, candles, and virtually everything else they used or consumed. If you heard a random hum in the background, that was my AC. It's very loud. I'm very sorry. At midday, there was dinner, in the evening, supper, then prayers, including a reading from the scriptures and psalm singing, then bed. If the weather warmed a little and the deep snow lay glimmering in the pale, brief sunshine, the girls might walk the few hundred yards to Captain Jonathan Walcott's house, where 17-year-old Mary Walcott lived, or the half-mile to Dr. and Mrs. Griggs' residence, to see the old couple's great-niece, Elizabeth Hubbard, also 17. Another friend, 12-year-old Ann Putnam, and a 17-year-old servant girl, Mercy Lewis, lived a mile away at Farmer Thomas Putnam's. Perhaps Betty and Abigail sometimes went further to visit other acquaintances, but given the harsh weather, rough terrain, and dirt roads, they cannot have done so too often, if ever. There were other obstacles as well. Visits for mere pleasure would have been regarded by adults as dubious activities bordering on the sinful. Some recent historians claim that the American Puritans were not the grim-faced killjoys of popular tradition, but relished pleasures such as food, drink, and conjugal sex. I hope I didn't pronounce that wrong. At hearty meals, they ate venison and other game from the forest, fish from the rivers, meat and poultry raised on their homesteads, and vegetables grown in their fields, spices imported from the West Indies, and herbs grown at home, flavored recipes brought from England, such as salmon and ale, and a pie of pork and apple. A variety of sauces to accompany roast veal and venison included a wine, vinegar, and nutmeg sauce, and another with orange juice and lemon slices. As in medieval England, cooks habitually mix sweet and savory flavors, not just within the same course, but in the same dish. Chicken was eaten with fruit, venison with maple syrup. A typical first course at dinner included chicken, soup, meat, vegetables, and a sweet and savory pudding. A second course may have consisted of fish, meat, or game pie, game, and fruit or custard pies. There was no sweet course as such. Everyone drank wine, beer, alcoholic cider with the meal. Alcohol was not at all disapproved of, though. Drunkenness, like any disorderly behavior, certainly was. Strict decorum, rather than abstinence, was the order of the day regarding physical needs. This applied to sex as to food. Though sexual relationships outside marriage were outlawed, sex within marriage was seen as a blessing from God. Anne Bradstreet, one of the first settlers and the only poet among the New England Puritans, wrote of her love for her husband in a way that leaves no doubt that it was sensual as well as deep and tender. These lines are taken from a poem called A Letter to Her Husband, Absent Upon Public Employment. I, like the earth this season, mourn in black. My son is gone so far in zodiac, whom whilst I enjoyed nor storms nor frost I felt, his warmth such frigid colds did cause to melt, my chilled limbs now numb till I forlorn. Return, return, sweet Sol from Capricorn. The Puritans wore colored clothes, not just black, and played simple instruments. They did not celebrate the religious festivals, even Christmas, but they socialized at harvest and roof raisings. This revised picture rightly reminds us of the historical context of New England Puritanism. Between the roisterous age of Elizabeth and the urban 18th century, the first American Puritans had been born in a land and era farmed for its lusty enjoyment of living. Their descendants, 100 years later, were to relish the material rewards of hard work and enterprise. All the same, the picture of the 17th century Puritans happily indulging in moderate pleasure is misleading. Despite the fact that they drank cider and ale with their meals and were free of the neurotic horror of sex we associate with low church Victorians, they were not displaced to marry Englanders. Their diaries, letters, and sermons leave no doubt that they regarded all activities besides work and prayer as potentially sinful distractions, and believed they should be extremely wary of impulses that led to fun or amusement. A useful guide to their stern outlook can be found in the list made in the 1590s by William Perkins, an English Puritan preacher of huge attitudes towards religion held by ordinary Englishmen that he finds utterly shocking. Such attitudes might seem eminently sensible today, but to Perkins and the New England Puritans, they demonstrated a lax, slothful approach instead of a properly zealous one. Most English people believe, Perkins says, with an incredulous dismay he assumes his readers will share, that God is served merely by rehearsing of the Ten Commandments, the Lord's Prayer, and the Creed, that none can tell whether he shall be saved or no certainly, that it is safest to do in religion as most do, that merry ballads and books as Goggin, Beavis of Southampton, etc., are good to drive away the time and to remove heart qualms, that you know all the preacher can tell you, that drinking and embezzling in the alehouse or tavern is good fellowship and shows a good guy in nature, and maintains neighborhood, that it was a good world where old religion was because themes were cheap. The delightful good humor of such an approach was invisible to New Englanders such as the Reverend Paris.